This is the April, May, June 2022 Personal Injury Update CLE. It's based on the monthly collections of decision summaries posted on the New York Appellate Digest website that deal with categories related to personal injury, including negligence, medical malpractice, products liability, labor law, construction law, and workers' compensation. The summaries on the New York Appellate Digest website are collected every month into reversal reports. So the April, May, and June reversal reports for personal injury are the written materials for this CLE. The page numbers referred to in the CLE are the pages of those reversal reports, and each monthly report starts all over again with page number one. So we will begin with the April personal injury reversal report. First case, Naftalayev, on pages 6 and 7. Here, a post-note of issue supplemental bill of particulars. That's the way the plaintiff characterized the document, as a supplemental bill of particulars. But the second department found that it was actually an amended bill of particulars. Again, this was after the note of issue was filed, and the document added new injuries. Because it was actually an amended bill of particulars, not merely a supplemental bill of particulars, leave of court was required, and because the plaintiff did not ask for the court's permission, the amended bill of particulars was struck. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court in the slip and fall case, held the document labeled a supplemental bill of particulars was actually a post-note of issue amended bill of particulars, which should not have been served without leave of court. The court wrote, the document that they denominated a supplemental bill of particulars was, in reality, an amended bill of particulars as they sought to add new injuries, and it cites CPLR 3043 subdivision B. The Supreme Court erred in denying that branch of defendant's motion, which was to strike the amended bill of particulars, denominated as a supplemental bill of particulars, which was served without leave of court and after the note of issue had been filed. So the takeaway, a supplemental bill of particulars which adds new injuries after the note of issues has been filed is actually an amended bill of particulars which can only be served with the permission of the court. Next is ORJI, O-R-J-I versus MTA Bus, on pages 7 and 8. It's a case involving a bus passenger who allegedly fell and was injured because of the movement of the bus. And it's a good explanation of the proof requirements for a case like this. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendant bus company, that's MTA, the MTA's motion to dismiss the complaint should have been granted. The court wrote, to establish a prima facie case of negligence against a common carrier for injuries sustained by a passenger as a result of the movement of the vehicle, a plaintiff must establish that the movement consisted of a jerk or lurch that was unusual and violent. A plaintiff may not satisfy the burden of proof merely by characterizing the stop as unusual and violent. There must be objective evidence of the force of the stop, sufficient to establish an inference that the stop was extraordinary and violent, of a different class than the jerks and jolts commonly experienced in city bus travel. In seeking summary judgment dismissing the complaint, common carriers have the burden of establishing that the movement of the vehicle was not unusual and violent. The nature of the incident, according to the plaintiff's deposition testimony, was that she was caused to fall as the bus stopped at an intersection. According to the plaintiff, who did not provide an estimate as to how fast the bus was traveling prior to stopping at the intersection, she was the only passenger on the bus who fell, although there was another passenger standing within 2 feet of her at the time. The plaintiff testified that she landed on the floor near where she was standing prior to falling down. This is not in itself sufficient to provide the objective support necessary to demonstrate that the movement of the bus was unusual and violent. So I take that to mean that if the evidence is that a person on a bus simply fell where he or she was standing, and there was no evidence that she was thrown to one side or the other or to the front or the back by the movement of the bus, there's no objective support for the claim that it was the movement of the bus that caused the fall, a violent and unusual movement. So the takeaway here, in order to survive a motion for summary judgment, a bus passenger's allegation his or her injury was caused by an unusual and violent movement of the bus must have some sort of objective support, which was absent here. And I assume that objective support would include evidence that she was thrown a distance from where she was standing before she fell, or I've seen in other cases a video camera on the bus showed some evidence that the movement of the bus was unusual and violent. But without some kind of objective support for the claim that it was the movement of the bus, a violent and unusual movement, that caused a plaintiff to fall, the case won't survive summary judgment. Next is Pacan versus Brown on page 8. It's a hunting accident case. And it's here just to illustrate that in order to make out a prima facie case in negligence, you no longer need to negate the fact that there was possibly comparative negligence. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's motion for summary judgment in this hunting accident case should have been granted. The defendant, like the plaintiff, was hunting turkey when he shot plaintiff and his friend, and the defendant subsequently pled guilty to attempted assault. The court wrote, "We agree with plaintiffs that they established as a matter of law that defendant was negligent by failing to exercise the degree of care that a reasonable person of ordinary prudence would exercise under the circumstances commensurate with the known dangers and risks reasonably to be foreseen, and that defendant failed to raise an issue of fact in response. We also agree with plaintiffs that tribal issues of fact regarding plaintiff's comparative negligence do not preclude an award of summary judgment in plaintiff's favor on the issue of defendant's negligence." So the takeaway here, comparative negligence is no longer a bar to summary judgment on liability. Comparative negligence is relevant only to damages. Next is Aviles on pages 9 and 10. It's a lawsuit brought by an inmate at the county jail alleging that the water in the jail was contaminated. The jail was operated by the county sheriff's office, and in general, the county is not vicariously liable for the acts of the sheriff. So the issue here was whether the county, in addition to the sheriff, could be sued. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff, an inmate at the Orange County Correctional Facility, stated a cause of action against the county as well as the county sheriff. Plaintiff alleged he was exposed to contaminated shower water at the jail. The cause of action against the county was not based on a vicarious liability theory. And again, the county is not vicariously liable for the acts of the sheriff's office. Rather, plaintiff stated a cause of action alleging the county was negligent in failing to ensure the safety of the water at the jail. That cause of action is distinct from the sheriff's duty to keep inmates safe, and the issue was properly raised for the first time on appeal. The court wrote, The complaint did not solely seek to hold the county vicariously liable for the actions of the sheriff and his deputies. The complaint alleged the county had a duty to maintain the correctional facility, including its water supply, in a safe and proper manner, and that the county's breach of that duty caused plaintiff to sustain personal injuries. The county's duty to provide and maintain the jail building is distinguishable from the sheriff's duty to receive and safely keep inmates in the jail over which the sheriff has custody. Contrary to the defendant's contention, the plaintiff's argument that the county is liable for its own negligence, as opposed to being vicariously liable for the negligence of the sheriff or his deputies, is not improperly raised for the first time on appeal. So the takeaway here, the county is not liable for the acts or omissions of the county sheriff under a vicarious liability theory. But here the allegation that the shower water at the jail was contaminated stated a cause of action against the county for its own negligence. Therefore, the action against the county should not have been dismissed. Next is Healy on pages 10 and 11. It's a labor law case, labor law section 240, subdivision 1. It's from the Court of Appeals, and it explains that cleaning work that is routine is not covered under labor law 240 subdivision 1. Unfortunately, the facts were not explained in the case, but they did. The Court of Appeals did explain the applicable law. Court of Appeals, reversing the appellate division, held plaintiff should not have been awarded summary judgment on the labor law 240 subdivision 1 cause of action, and defendant's summary judgment motion should have been granted. The issue was whether plaintiff was injured doing cleaning work covered by the labor law. The Court of Appeals held plaintiff was doing routine work, which therefore did not qualify as cleaning under the labor law 246 subdivision 1. The facts were not explained, as I said. The court wrote, labor law section 240 subdivision 1 requires certain contractors and property owners to provide adequate safety devices when workers engage in particular tasks involving elevation-related risks. To recover under Section 240 Subdivision 1 for an injury caused by a failure to provide such safety devices, plaintiffs must first show that they were engaged in one of that section's enumerated activities, including, among others, cleaning. To determine whether an activity is cleaning within the meaning of the statute, courts apply a four-factor analysis. The first factor considers whether the work is routine, in the sense that it is the type of job that occurs on a daily, weekly, or other relatively frequent and recurring basis as part of the ordinary maintenance and care of commercial premises. This factor does not involve a fact-specific assessment of plaintiff's regular tasks. It instead asks whether the type of work would be expected to recur with relative frequency as part of the ordinary maintenance and care of a commercial property. Here, plaintiff's work was routine within the meaning of the first factor, which therefore weighs against concluding that he was cleaning. Viewed in totality, the factors do not militate in favor of placing the task in the category of cleaning. So the takeaway here, injury while cleaning is not covered under Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 if it is done routinely. Next is the Luna case on pages 11 and 12. It's another labor law case, and it's another case dealing with whether the activity engaged in by the plaintiff at the time of the injury was covered by Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the elevator which descended and crushed plaintiff's decedent who had entered the shaft was not a falling object within the meaning of Labor Law Section 240 Subdivision 1. Therefore, the complaint against defendants must be dismissed. The court wrote, plaintiff's decedent, an elevator mechanic, entered an elevator shaft on the lobby level. under an elevator that he had sent to one of the floors above. After the shaft doors closed, the call button was pressed and the elevator descended to the lobby, crushing the decedent. The parties agree that the elevator was working normally in the automatic setting at the time of the accident. The labor law section 240 subdivision 1 claim must be dismissed because the elevator did not fall as a result of the force of gravity, but descended in automatic mode as it was designed to do. So the takeaway, in order to be covered under labor law section 240 subdivision 1, this elevator accident must have been the result of the elevator falling, because the elevator was descending normally when it struck and killed the plaintiff. The complaint was dismissed. Next is Peters on pages 12 and 13. It's another labor law 240 subdivision 1 case. It also involves labor law 241 subdivision 6. And the issue here is whether the debris that injured plaintiff's eye, falling debris, was what the court should consider de minimis, and whether the force with which the debris fell was de minimis, which would take it out of the reach of those statutes. First Department, modifying Supreme Court, held there were questions of fact about liability pursuant to labor law 240 subdivision 1 and 241 subdivision 6. Plaintiff was working in a shaft when pebble-sized debris fell on him, allegedly seriously injuring his eye. There were questions of fact whether the distance the debris fell was de minimis and whether the force with which the debris fell was de minimis. There was also a question of fact whether planking should have been installed above the shaft to protect against falling debris. The court wrote, there are issues of fact as to whether the debris that fell on plaintiff, taking into account the elevation differential, the debris's weight, and the amount of force it could generate, was a load that required securing for the purposes of the undertaking at the time it fell, and whether his injury was a direct consequence of defendant's failure to provide adequate protection against the risk arising from a physically significant elevation differential. The trier of fact could find that the elevation differential between plaintiff and the level from which the debris fell was de minimis, and that the debris's weight was inconsequential, or that the debris could not have generated any meaningful amount of force, and determined that plaintiff's injuries were the result of a usual and ordinary danger at a construction site. However, the trier of fact could determine that the elevation differential of at least one story was not de minimis, that the weight of the debris and the force it was capable of generating were significant, and that the debris should have been secured for the purpose of the undertaking. So the takeaway here, there were questions of fact whether the injury from falling pebble-sized debris is covered under labor law 240 subdivision 1 and 241 subdivision 6. The force generated by the falling debris could be found to be de minimis by the jury, but that just simply raised a question of fact. Next is Fonocchi versus Live Nation, pages 13 and 14. Another labor law 240 subdivision 1 case. This time there was a defense verdict, and the Fourth Department reversed, found that the plaintiff's motion to set aside the defense verdict should have been granted, and went ahead and awarded judgment in favor of the plaintiffs. And the issue here was the effect of the plaintiff being ordered to lift a heavy box. His boss ordered him to manually lift a heavy box, and the relationship between that order and the fact that there was a forklift available. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's motion to set aside the defense verdict in this Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 action should have been granted. The Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 claim was reinstated, and judgment in favor of plaintiffs was granted by the appellate court. Apparently, plaintiff was injured when lifting a heavy box after the stage manager directed him to do so. The fact that a forklift was available would only raise an issue of comparative negligence, which will not defeat a labor law 240 subdivision 1 claim. The court wrote, although defendants established that there was an available safety device, i.e. a forklift, and that plaintiff knew that it was available and that he was expected to use it, plaintiffs established that the stage manager instructed plaintiff and his co-workers to lift the box manually. Regardless of whether that stage manager was plaintiff's actual supervisor, plaintiff was under no obligation to demand safer methods for moving the box. To expect plaintiff to refuse the stage manager's demands overlooks the realities of construction work. When faced with an instruction to use an inadequate device or no device at all, many workers would be understandably reticent to object for fear of jeopardizing their employment and their livelihoods. So the takeaway here, plaintiff was directed to lift a heavy box manually. A worker is expected to follow instructions. The fact that a forklift was available and that the worker knew he was to use it was not determinative. The fact that most workers will follow instructions in order not to lose their job was taken into consideration. And the fact that there was a forklift available was simply an issue related to comparative negligence, which will not defeat a summary judgment motion on a Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 action. Next is Hoyer on pages 14 and 15. It's another Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 case, and it brings up a couple of issues. The property owner was renovating a barn, making it into a music studio. So the court found that there was a question of fact whether that was a commercial project. And if it was a commercial project, the homeowner's exemption to the labor law liability would not apply. The plaintiff was delivering sheetrock through an opening that had heavy doors, but the hinges had been taken off the doors in order to restore them, and the doors were held in place by wooden wedges. The doors fell on the plaintiff as he was attempting to deliver the sheetrock. The Third Department, modifying Supreme Court, held that the defendant's motion for summary judgment on the Labor Law 200 and 240 Subdivision 1 causes of action should not have been granted. Again, plaintiff was told to deliver sheetrock through an opening where heavy doubled barn doors were being restored, the hinges had been removed, and the doors were held in place by wooden wedges. The doors fell on the plaintiff. The Third Department found that there were questions of fact whether the doors presented a dangerous condition, that's Labor Law 200, or an elevated related hazard, which is Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1, and whether the project was commercial in nature such that the homeowner exemption did not apply. With respect to the homeowner exemption, the court wrote, although Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 imposes a non-delegable duty upon owners to protect workers engaged in construction-related activities, the legislature has carved out an exception for the owners of one- and two-family dwellings who contract for but do not direct or control the work. That exemption, however, is not available to an owner who uses or intends to use the dwelling for only commercial purposes. Defendants, as the parties seeking the benefit of the statutory exemption, had the burden of establishing that the property was not being used solely for commercial purposes. They failed to do this. Defendant's deposition testimony established that he is a professional musician and that the structure was being altered to use as a music studio and a photography workplace. Defendants failed to submit an affidavit addressing whether they intended to use the structure for commercial or non-commercial purposes. We find that the defendants failed to demonstrate their entitlement to the homeowner exemption as a matter of law, and a question of fact exists regarding the application of the homeowner's exemption. So the main takeaway here, homeowner exemption to the labor law liability does not apply where the construction is for commercial purposes. Here, the defendant did not demonstrate the renovation of the barn for use as a music studio was not for commercial purposes. Defendant's motion for summary judgment on the Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 cause of action should not have been granted. Next is Jersky on pages 15 and 16. Another Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 case, here involving a fall from a ladder. And the main issue was whether plaintiff was the sole proximate cause of the accident. Second Department held that conflicting facts precluded summary judgment in this ladder fall case. Plaintiff alleged the ladder was unsecured and shifted when he attempted to descend. The defendant alleged plaintiff told his supervisor he lost his balance and jumped off the ladder, which raised a question whether plaintiff's actions were the sole proximate cause of the accident. The court wrote, the defendants raised a triable issue of fact as to whether the ladder shifted to the right and backwards as the plaintiff testified, or whether the plaintiff's own actions were the sole proximate cause of the subject accident. The defendant submitted an affidavit from plaintiff's supervisor who averred that the plaintiff had told him just after the accident occurred, while he was still on the roof, that he had lost his balance as he descended the ladder and jumped off the ladder. The different versions of the accident given by the plaintiff create triable issues of fact that require denial of the motion, including a triable issue of fact as to the plaintiff's credibility. So here, evidence that the plaintiff told his supervisor he lost his balance and jumped from the ladder created a triable issue of fact about whether plaintiff's action was the sole proximate cause of the accident. And the sub-issue here is the issue about when a ladder fall is actionable under Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 if the ladder itself didn't cause the fall. The equipment is therefore not to blame, and Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 would not apply. Next is Kutaya on pages 16 and 17. It's another Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 case, a ladder fall case. It's out of the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals reversed the appellate division, and there was a three-judge dissent. The Court of Appeals, reversing the appellate division, held plaintiff in this Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 ladder fall case should not have been awarded summary judgment. So this is reversing an award of summary judgment to the plaintiff. Plaintiff used an A-frame ladder in a closed position because of limited space. While rerouting pipes in the ceiling, plaintiff received an electric shock and fell to the floor. The majority found questions of fact were raised about whether the ladder failed to protect plaintiff and whether other safety devices should have been provided. The court wrote, an accident alone is insufficient to establish a violation of Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 or causation. Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 is designed to protect against harm directly flowing from the application of the force of gravity to an object or person. We agree with the dissent below that plaintiff was not entitled to partial summary judgment on his Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 claim. Questions of fact exist as to whether the ladder failed to provide proper protection, whether plaintiff should have been provided with additional safety devices, and whether the ladder's purported inadequacy or the absence of additional safety devices was a proximate cause of plaintiff's accident. So the takeaway here, plaintiff was apparently electrocuted while standing on a closed A-frame ladder and he fell to the floor. The happening of the accident alone did not establish that the ladder failed to protect plaintiff or that other safety equipment should have been provided to the plaintiff. Therefore, a plaintiff was not entitled to summary judgment on the Labor Law 241 cause of action, And again, there was a three-judge dissenting opinion. Next is Gregorian on pages 17 and 18, another labor law 240 subdivision 1 case. The issue here involves a heavy object that was leaning against a wall and fell over and injured the plaintiff. So the question was whether that type of incident falls within the scope of a labor law 240 subdivision 1. First Department reversing Supreme Court held that the plaintiff was entitled to summary judgment on his 240 subdivision 1 action. A heavy fire pump that was leaning against the wall, unsecured, tipped over and struck the plaintiff. The court wrote, liability under labor law 240 subdivision 1 arises where a safety device of the kind enumerated in the statute either proved inadequate to shield against injury resulting directly from the application of the force of gravity to a person or object, or where no safety device was provided to shield against such injury. Plaintiff was injured when he and two co-workers were assigned to run conduits along the wall and ceiling of an approximately 8 by 10 foot fire pump room. As they were looking at the wall and ceiling and deciding how to proceed, plaintiff felt a sharp pain in his leg when a 3 to 4 foot tall, 300 to 500 pound fire pump, which had been standing upright on the floor on its narrower end and unsecured, fell on his leg. Where a load positioned on the same level as the injured worker falls a short distance, Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 applies if the load, due to its weight, is capable of generating significant force. Here, the fire pump was required to be secured against tipping or falling, and the failure to secure it was a violation of Labor Law Section 240 Subdivision 1. So the takeaway here, a heavy fire pump, 3 to 4 feet in height, was leaning against the wall on the same level as plaintiff when it tipped over and struck him. An unsecured object positioned on the same level as the injured party, which generates significant force when it falls over, is covered by Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1. Next is LaPorta on pages 18 and 19. It's another ladder fall case, a Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 action. Here there was evidence the ladder was defective, it was missing rubber feet, and it shifted. And that's what caused the fall. The plaintiff brought a summary judgment motion before depositions were taken. The Supreme Court found that the motion was premature, but the First Department reversed and reinstated the summary judgment in favor of plaintiff. First Department reversing Supreme Court held that plaintiff was entitled to summary judgment on his 240 subdivision 1 cause of action in this A-frame ladder fall case. The court noted that the motion for summary judgment was not premature, even though no depositions had been taken. The court wrote, plaintiff established prima facie that the defendant is liable under Section 240 Subdivision 1 through plaintiff and his co-workers' affidavits that the unstable 8-foot A-frame ladder, which was missing rubber feet, shifted, causing him to fall. It was undisputed that defendant was the owner of the property. Plaintiff also established that his work of retrofitting light fixtures was covered under Section 240 Subdivision 1 and did not constitute mere maintenance. We reject defendant's argument that plaintiff's motion was premature. The fact that no depositions have been taken does not preclude summary judgment in plaintiff's favor, as the defendant failed to show that discovery might lead to facts that would support its opposition to the motion. Defendant also failed to show that facts essential to its opposition were within plaintiff's exclusive knowledge. Its argument that deposition testimony might further illuminate issues raised by the affidavits is unavailing. The mere hope that evidence sufficient to defeat a motion for summary judgment may be uncovered during discovery is insufficient to deny the motion. So the takeaway here, in order for a pre-discovery summary judgment motion to be deemed premature, it's the opposing party which must demonstrate discovery might lead to facts which would support opposition to the motion. And the defendant failed to do that here. And this case also indicates that where a ladder is defective and that defect is alleged to have caused the plaintiff to fall from the ladder, that's pretty much considered an open and shut case. Next is Nucci on page 19. The issue here was whether the work that the plaintiff was doing was within the scope of Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 and Labor Law 241 Subdivision 6. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the plaintiff's work, which was boarding up a vacant house to prevent access, was within the scope of work covered by those two statutes. Plaintiff allegedly fell from a ladder when attempting to board up a window. The court wrote, plaintiff's work of boarding up the house, thus making it uninhabitable, was altering the premises within the meaning of Labor Law Section 240 Subdivision 1, as it constituted a significant physical change to the configuration or composition of the building. Further, as the work the plaintiff was engaged in constituted alteration, it was within the scope of construction work for purposes of Labor Law Section 241 Subdivision 6. So the takeaway, boarding up a vacant house is a covered activity under Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 and 241 Subdivision 6. Next is Rooney on pages 20 and 21. It raises several issues, whether plaintiff's work on the elevator was routine maintenance, which would not be covered under Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 and 241 Subdivision 6, and whether one of the defendants, based on a subcontract, was liable as a statutory agent under Labor Law 200, 240 Subdivision 1, and 241 Subdivision 6. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held, one, plaintiff's work on the elevator was not routine maintenance, and therefore Sections 240 Subdivision 1 and 241 Subdivision 6 applied. Two, Labor Law 241 6 cause of action based on the industrial code provisions requiring the guarding of hazardous openings should not have been dismissed. And three, there are questions of fact whether one defendant, based on a subcontract, was liable as a statutory agent under Labor Law 200, 240 Subdivision 1 and 241 Subdivision 6. The court wrote, plaintiff and a co-worker lowered a building's freight elevator into the basement to allow plaintiff to perform work on top of the elevator. Plaintiff testified that he spent about 40 minutes performing that work, which involved making changes to the elevator in order to prevent people from accessing a first-floor renovation site by means of the elevator's rear door. The elevator's front door opened onto an outdoor area. After performing this task, plaintiff claims that he tripped on a wooden ramp which led from the loading dock to the elevator and fell. Plaintiff was engaged in altering the premises within the meaning of Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1, since his work was intended to secure the premises in preparation for the renovation project. The Labor Law 241 Subdivision 6 claim should be reinstated as it is based on alleged violations of the Industrial Code, since there are issues of fact as to whether plaintiff's accident was proximately caused by the lack of a compliant safety railing guarding the hazardous opening. And it is undisputed that the opening was not guarded by a substantial cover fastened in place. There is testimonial evidence that the subcontract made the defendant, Edge, responsible for performing all aspects of the sidewalk excavation, including safety procedures. There are issues of fact as to whether Edge created or had notice of the defective condition that caused plaintiff to fall into the excavation hole. So one of the takeaways here is a subcontractor responsible for safety procedures can be liable as a statutory agent under Labor Law 200, 240 Subdivision 1, and 241 Subdivision 6. Next is Lazo, pages 21 and 22. The plaintiff fell from a beam, an eight-inch wide beam, and the court found that that was being used as the equivalent of a scaffold and therefore came within the reach of Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held claimant's motion for summary judgment on the Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 cause of action should have been granted. The claimant, Lazo, was moving along an 8-inch wide, 17-foot long beam suspended above a platform when he fell. He was attached to two safety lines, which he had to detach and reattach to anchorage points. He fell while in the process of reattaching one of the lines. The second line did not prevent the fall. The court wrote, Lazo would use a hook at the end of each safety line to secure it to various anchorage points on another horizontal beam located above him. To move across the beam, workers were instructed to unhook the first safety line from the first anchorage point, connect it to a second anchorage point, and then repeat this process with the second safety line. This effectively allowed workers to move along the beam while always having at least one safety line attached to an anchorage point. Lazo's deposition testimony established that his accident was within the purview of Labor Law Section 240 Subdivision 1, since the beam from which he fell was being used as the functional equivalent of a scaffold. Lazo's deposition testimony also established that his second safety line was attached to an anchorage point, but was nevertheless insufficient to prevent him from falling. So the takeaway here, an 8-inch wide, 17-foot long beam suspended 8 feet above a platform was the functional equivalent of a scaffold. The fall from the beam, therefore, was in the scope of Labor Law Section 240 Subdivision 1. Next is Ahmed on pages 23 and 24. It's a medical malpractice case brought against the New York City Health and Hospital Corporation. The case raises two issues. One was the timeliness of the motion for permission to file a late notice of claim. And the other was whether the application to file a late notice of claim should be granted on the merits. The timeliness of the motion for permission to file a late notice of claim is primarily a civil procedure issue, and it was covered in the civil procedure CLE. But the other issue addressed by the court here was whether the defendant, here the New York City Health and Hospital Corporation, had timely knowledge of the nature of the claim, because that's one of the things you have to prove in order to be granted permission to file a late notice of claim. And here they found that the medical records actually demonstrated that the defendant had actual knowledge of the claim, timely actual knowledge, and that was one reason the court found that the permission to file a late notice should be granted. The court wrote, the medical records provided the defendants with actual knowledge of the essential facts constituting plaintiff's claim. The records evinced that a stroke code was called shortly after plaintiff's presentation to the hospital, that based on an assessment of her condition, it was decided that a tissue plasminogen activator was not needed, and that it was later determined that the plaintiff had suffered a stroke, but that it was too late to administer that drug. So here, the medical records generated by the hospital, by the defendant, demonstrated that they had enough knowledge of what happened to know that there was a potential lawsuit here, and that therefore they had timely knowledge of the essence of the plaintiff's claim. Next is Almonte. On pages 25 and 26, it raises some two unusual issues in a medical malpractice case. The first issue is whether the plaintiff was given adequate discharge instructions. And the other issue is whether a doctor should have reviewed the physician assistant's report before co-signing it. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held questions of fact precluded summary judgment in favor of defendant registered nurse, Varis, defendant physician's assistant, Rogan, and defendant doctor who co-signed the physician assistant's chart, Shawcut. Plaintiff alleged she was told the lump in her breast was a cyst and was given no follow-up instructions. Defendants allege plaintiff was given the appropriate follow-up instructions to rule out cancer. Several months later, plaintiff was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer. The court wrote, defendants Varas and Rogan made a prima facie showing that they did not depart from the applicable standard of care in providing plaintiff with verbal or written discharge instructions. There are disputed issues of fact, however, that preclude summary judgment, including what, if anything at all, plaintiff was told upon discharge. Dr. Shawcut established prima facie that she did not depart from the applicable standard of care through her expert physician's opinion that co-signing a physician assistant's chart is a customary administrative function in major accredited hospitals, and that she acted within that standard of care by co-signing plaintiff's chart. In opposition, however, plaintiff raised an issue of fact through her expert, the expert's opinions, that this function is not merely administrative, that in accordance with American Medical Association policy, physicians must review the physician assistant's work to ensure conformity with the standard of care, not to simply rubber stamp medical records for administrative purposes only, and that Dr. Shawcut failed to conform to this standard of care by not recognizing alleged deficiencies in plaintiff's chart and by not instructing Rogan to call plaintiff to tell her that she required imaging promptly in order to rule out a more serious condition, such as breast cancer. So the takeaway here, in this medical malpractice case, whether a registered nurse and a physician's assistant gave plaintiff adequate discharge instructions after discovery of a lump in plaintiff's breast raised a question of fact. In addition, whether a doctor who co-signed the physician assistant's chart should have reviewed the chart raised a question of fact. At this point, I'm going to insert the first verification code to be placed on your attorney's affirmation for this April, May, June 2022 personal injury update CLE. The first verification code is CHART. Again, the first verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this April, May, June 2022 personal injury update is CHART. Next is Matter of Smith, pages 26 and 27. It's a case that deals with general municipal law, section 207A, which allows disability benefits for police and firefighters if they're injured in the performance of their duties. Third Department held that the Supreme Court properly found petitioner, who was a probationary firefighter, was entitled to disability benefits under General Municipal Law 207A. The fact that petitioner was injured while training for a test required for the completion of a fire basic training program did not mean petitioner was not injured in the performance of his duties. That was the city's argument. The court wrote, although petitioner's injury did not occur in the course of his actual performance of the required test, successful completion of the candidate physical ability test was a necessary requirement of petitioner's position, and petitioner was engaged in the expected and foreseeable task of practicing for that test during a mandatory training program that was part of his duties as a probationary firefighter. The record reflects that petitioner was attending the fire academy at the direction of the city, that the training was paid for by the city, and that petitioner was receiving full pay for his attendance and participation in the program. Mindful that, as a remedial statute, General Municipal Law 207A should be liberally construed in favor of the injured employees the statute was designed to protect, we find the requisite causal relationship exists between petitioner's job duties and his injury. So the takeaway here, a probationary firefighter injured while training to complete a fire basic training program was injured in the performance of his duties within the meaning of General Municipal Law Section 207A, and therefore was entitled to disability benefits. Next is Waterbury on pages 27 and 28. It's a negligent hiring and supervision case, First Department, over an extensive dissent, held that the plaintiff, Waterbury, stated causes of action for 1, violation of the New York City Administrative Code provision which prohibits the disclosure of intimate images without consent, 2, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and 3, negligent hiring, supervision, and retention. The plaintiff, Waterbury, was a dancer with the defendant New York City Ballet. The defendant, Finlay, who allegedly disclosed the images, was also a New York City Ballet dancer. The negligent hiring cause of action is against New York City Ballet as the defendant dancer's employer. That's Finlay's employer. The court wrote, Waterbury's allegations that images depict her engaged in sexual activity suffice, that's according to Administrative Code Section 10-180, that's the New York City Administrative Code. Construing the complaint liberally and according Waterbury the benefit of every possible favorable inference, the allegations that Finlay, that's the other dancer, shared images of her breasts are also sufficient, and it cites another Administrative Code provision. Waterbury also sufficiently alleges that Finlay intended to cause her economic, physical, or substantial emotional harm. A result is intended if the act is done with the purpose of accomplishing such a result or with knowledge that to a substantial certainty such a result will ensue. Waterbury alleges that New York City Ballet dancers and others affiliated with New York City Ballet shared images and commentary regarding other women, and that New York City Ballet knew that Finlay and other dancers were degrading and exploiting young women. She asserts that New York City Ballet implicitly encouraged this behavior. Waterbury states that New York City Ballet knew of Finlay's sexual conduct towards young women and took no steps to prevent such conduct. So those allegations supported the cause of action for negligent supervision on behalf of the employer, New York City Ballet. Next is Reynoso, page 28. It's a personal injury case where there was expert testimony from the defendant's expert, and the plaintiff sought to have her treating physician come in as a rebuttal witness. So the question was whether evidence from this radiologist, which could have been presented in plaintiff's case in chief, was properly allowed in rebuttal. The First Department noted that the trial judge properly allowed plaintiff to call her treating physician to rebut the testimony of defendant's expert, even though the doctor's testimony could have been presented in her case in chief. The court wrote, the trial court providently exercised its discretion in permitting plaintiff to call her treating radiologist as a rebuttal witness. While plaintiff's radiologist's testimony could have been offered as part of her case in chief, and her failure to offer the testimony at that time deprived her of the right to make use of it as affirmative evidence, she still had the right to offer the testimony in order to impeach or discredit the testimony of defendant's expert radiologist. So generally, in a civil case, a judge has the discretion to allow a plaintiff to present rebuttal evidence which could have been presented in the case in chief. The only proviso is that that evidence presented in rebuttal is not considered affirmative evidence. It's considered evidence for impeachment. Next is DeBarcacel. On page 29, it's a slip and fall case. The plaintiff alleged that a leak in her ceiling caused the water on the floor, which in turn caused her to fall. She sued the property owner and the property management company, but she also sued an officer or a shareholder in the property management company, whose name was John Millevoy. The court held that the property management company and the owner of the property were properly sued, but the officer of the property management company could not be held individually liable. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, determined the complaint against the individual defendant, John Millevoy, an officer or shareholder of the property management company, the defendant M&L Millevoy Management, must be dismissed. Plaintiff alleged a leak in the ceiling of her apartment caused her slip and fall. The court wrote, the complaint should be dismissed against the individual defendant, John Millevoy, because there's no allegation that his liability stems from an act of misfeasance or malfeasance as opposed to nonfeasance. A corporate officer or shareholder may not be held personally liable for a failure to act. The defendant owner and defendant management company, on the other hand, have not established their entitlement to judgment as a matter of law. So the takeaway here, a corporate officer or shareholder cannot be personally liable for nonfeasance, doing nothing, as opposed to misfeasance. The complaint against the corporate officer or shareholder here was dismissed, but the complaint against the corporation, the property management corporation, was not. Next is San Antonio on page 30, another slip and fall case. And the issue was whether the owner of the property, who installed a composite material at the top of a staircase, could be held liable for creation of a dangerous condition. It was alleged that the composite material became wet with rain and slippery and was the cause of plaintiff's fall. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion for summary judgment in this slip and fall case should not have been granted. Plaintiff alleged that composite material used at the top of a staircase was inappropriate for that purpose, because the surface became slippery when wet from rain. The Second Department found that the defendants did not demonstrate they did not have constructive knowledge of that condition, mainly because the evidence relied upon was inadmissible hearsay. But the Second Department also noted the plaintiff must show more than the creation of a dangerous condition to hold the defendants liable. It must also be shown the defendants knew or should have known of the danger. The court wrote, in a premises liability case, a defendant property owner or a party in possession or control of real property who moves for summary judgment has the initial burden of making a prima facie showing that it neither created the alleged defective condition nor had actual or constructive notice of its existence. Contrary to the plaintiff's contention, the defendants may not be held liable merely because they created the allegedly dangerous condition by directing the installation of the composite decking material on the landing. Absent a statute imposing strict liability, a defendant may not be held liable for creating a dangerous or defective condition upon property unless the defendant had actual, constructive, or imputed knowledge of the danger created. So the takeaway here, it may be an obvious point, but in order to hold a property owner liable for creating a dangerous condition, the plaintiff must not only show that the defendant created the condition, but also that the defendant was aware of the danger. In this case, the defendant installed a composite flooring at the top of a stairwell, which allegedly became slippery when wet, just proving that the defendant installed the floor and that the floor became slippery when wet would not be enough. Next is Tishman Construction Corporation, page 31. It's another slip and fall case, but it mainly deals with the reach of a vehicle insurance policy and what use of a vehicle means. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the plaintiff's falling into a hole after he was finished loading his truck did not result from his use of the truck within the meaning of the insurance policies. The court said, while use of an automobile includes loading and unloading, an accident does not arise from the use of an automobile merely because it occurs during the loading or unloading process. Rather, it must be the result of some act or omission related to the use of the vehicle. So here, plaintiff's falling into a hole on the premises after he had loaded his truck did not result from use of the truck within the meaning of the insurance policies. Next is JG versus Academy Charter Elementary School. It's a case against a school based on a slip and fall by a student. But the issue is basically one of the criteria for filing a late notice of claim. And it differs from the case that we just discussed, where it was found that the hospital records themselves gave the hospital timely notice of the potential lawsuit, because the records themselves demonstrated that the hospital may be at fault. Here the question was whether the school's awareness of the slip and fall at the time it happened could be considered knowledge of the potential lawsuit. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the petitioner's application to deem the late notice of claim timely served should not have been granted. Apparently, petitioner's child tripped and fell on a stairwell at her school. The fact that the school was aware of the child's injuries at the time does not mean the school was aware of a potential lawsuit. The year-long delay was not adequately explained. Infancy is not enough. And the petitioners did not show the school was not prejudiced by the delay, the court wrote. The appellant's knowledge of the accident, that's the school's knowledge of the accident and injury, without more, does not constitute actual knowledge of the essential facts constituting the claim, at least where the incident and the injury do not necessarily occur only as the result of fault for which it may be liable. The petitioner mother stated in an affidavit submitted in support of the application that the school nurse called her on the day of the accident, advising her that her daughter fell on the stairs and injured her foot. This statement did not provide the appellant, that's the school, with the actual knowledge of the facts underlying the petitioner's claim of negligent supervision. Although the petitioner mother stated in her affidavit that she spoke to an employee of the school about the accident approximately 2 months after it occurred, the mother's affidavit indicated that the employee had no information or details to share. Letters sent by the petitioner's attorneys to the school did not advise it of the essential facts underlying the negligent supervision claim. So the takeaway here, an application to serve a late notice of claim against the school may be granted if the school had timely knowledge of the claim, but that doesn't mean timely knowledge of the injury or the incident. It means timely knowledge of a potential lawsuit. Next is Lu Wang on page 33. It's a traffic accident case, and it deals with a New York City administrative code provision which criminalizes striking a pedestrian who has the right of way. It's an unclassified misdemeanor. The defendant pled guilty to that unclassified misdemeanor, and the plaintiff in this case was seeking the records of that guilty plea. In addition to pleading guilty to that unclassified misdemeanor, the defendant also pled guilty to a traffic violation, Vehicle and Traffic Law, Section 1146. And under the criminal procedure law, the records of traffic infraction convictions are sealed. So the city argued here that the records of the guilty plea to the administrative code violation, the unclassified misdemeanor, should be considered sealed, just like the traffic infraction. But the First Department disagreed. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff in this vehicle pedestrian accident case was entitled to the records of the driver's guilty plea to an unclassified misdemeanor under New York City Administrative Code, which criminalizes striking a pedestrian who has the right of way. The unclassified misdemeanor is not covered by the sealing statute, Criminal Procedure Law, Section 160.55, which seals the records of vehicle and traffic law infractions. The court wrote, defendant driver was arrested, charged, and subsequently pled guilty to Administrative Code of the City of New York, Section 19-190, Subdivision B, an unclassified misdemeanor, and to Vehicle and Traffic Law, Section 1146, a traffic violation, for failing to yield to plaintiff's decedent and causing him injury. Plaintiff now seeks the records pertaining to the driver's unclassified misdemeanor. The city defendants argue that these records are not discoverable because they overlap with the driver's traffic infraction records, which are sealed pursuant to CPL 160.55. Under CPL 160.55, all records and papers relating to the arrest or prosecution of an individual convicted of a traffic infraction or violation following a criminal action or proceeding shall be sealed and not made available to any person or public or private agency. Plaintiff is entitled to the driver's records pertaining to his unclassified misdemeanor, as the records are not subject to CPL 160.55, and it does not appear that they were sealed. To the extent these records contain references or information related solely to the driver's sealed traffic violation case, the city must redact or remove it from its production. So the takeaway here, although the records of traffic infractions are sealed under Criminal Procedure Law 160.55, the records of a violation of the New York City Administrative Code, which criminalizes striking a pedestrian who has the right of way, are not subject to that sealing statute. Therefore, the plaintiff in this vehicle pedestrian accident case was entitled to those records. Next is Samnath on pages 34 and 35. It's an intersection traffic accident case. The issue is failure to stop at a stop sign and also failure to see what should have been seen. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's motion for summary judgment in this intersection traffic accident case should have been granted. The court wrote, plaintiffs established their prima facie entitlement to summary judgment by averring that at the time of the accident, their vehicle was traveling westbound through an intersection when defendant's vehicle failed to stop at a stop sign and struck of the driver's side of plaintiff's vehicle. A presumption of negligence arises from the failure of a driver at a stop sign to yield the right of way to the vehicle on the highway in violation of Vehicle and Traffic Law, Section 1142. Defendants claim that defendant stopped at the stop sign and checked for oncoming traffic but did not see plaintiff's vehicle until it suddenly appeared in front of her as she proceeded into the intersection, fails to rebut the presumption of negligence arising from her failure to yield the right of way to plaintiff's vehicle, but instead indicates that she was negligent in failing to see what was there to be seen. So the takeaway, failure to stop at a stop sign raises a presumption of negligence in an intersection traffic accident case. Proceeding into the intersection and striking a car which has the right of way constituted a negligent failure to see what should have been seen. Next is Ellsworth on pages 35 and 36. The issue here was the defendant was in the far right lane, which was designated as a turn only lane, a right turn only lane. And the issue was whether a driver in the middle lane, which could be used to go straight or turn right, could assume that the driver in the far right lane would make the right turn. And here, the driver in the right lane went straight and struck the driver in the middle lane who was attempting to turn right. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's motion for summary judgment against the defendant Rubio should not have been granted, and defendant Rubio's motion for summary judgment should have been granted. Plaintiff was a passenger in a taxi driven by defendant Mai Angamarca. Mai Angamarca was in the far right lane, which was for right turns only. Rubio, another defendant sued by the plaintiff passenger, was in the middle lane, which could be used to go straight or turn right. When Rubio attempted the right turn, Mai Angamarca continued straight and struck Rubio's car. The court wrote, the Rubio defendants established their prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law by demonstrating that the sole proximate cause of the accident was Mai Angamarca's vehicle continuing straight through the intersection in disregard of a traffic sign directing that his lane was for right turns only. Based upon Mai Angamarca's disregard of the traffic sign, he was in violation of vehicle and traffic law, and thus he was negligent as a matter of law. Rubio was entitled to assume that Mai Angamarca would obey the traffic sign requiring the right turn. Indeed, the plaintiff testified at his deposition that he saw that Rubio had signaled before making a legal right turn from the middle lane, that Mai Angamarca started to accelerate toward the intersection while Rubio's vehicle was turning, and that he did not believe Rubio was at fault in the happening of the accident. So again, the driver in the middle lane, which could either go straight or turn right, could properly assume that the driver in the far right lane would turn right and was not at fault in this accident when that driver went straight. Next is matter of Manbod versus New York City Transit Authority. It's another traffic accident case, and it's another late notice of claim case. And it again deals with the issue with whether the defendant here, the city, had timely knowledge of the potential lawsuit. So the issue again is whether the defendant simply knew of the incident or knew that there was a potential lawsuit stemming from the incident. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the petition seeking leave to file a late notice of claim should have been granted. It was alleged defendant New York City Transit Authority's bus collided with a New York City sanitation truck, which then collided with petitioner's car. The Transit Authority investigated the accident and therefore had knowledge of the essential facts of the claim. Because the defendant had timely actual knowledge of the potential claim and did not demonstrate prejudice from the delay, petitioner did not need to present a reasonable excuse for the late notice. The court wrote, as the authority acquired timely knowledge of the essential facts constituting petitioner's claim, the petitioner met his initial burden of showing that the authority would not be prejudiced by the late notice of claim. In response to the petitioner's initial showing, the authority failed to come forward with particularized evidence demonstrating that the late notice of claim substantially prejudiced its ability to defend the claim on the merits. Since the authority had actual knowledge of the essential facts underlying the claim and no substantial prejudice to the authority was demonstrated, the petitioner's failure to provide a reasonable excuse for the delay in serving the notice of claim did not bar granting the leave to file the late notice. So the takeaway here, the defendant, the New York City Transit Authority, investigated the traffic accident involving the petitioner's car and therefore had timely notice of the essential facts of the potential lawsuit. In that situation, in the absence of prejudice to the defendant caused by petitioner's failure to timely file a notice of claim, petitioner need not provide a reasonable excuse and leave to file a late notice should be granted. Next is a workers' compensation case, Waters, on pages 37 and 38. The claimant was struck by a car when he was riding his bicycle to work. That is usually not compensable under the workers' compensation law, but there is something called a special errand exception, which this case discussed. The third department, remitting the matter to the Workers' Compensation Board, held that the board did not address the basis of the workers' compensation law judge's ruling that claimant was entitled to benefits. Claimant was struck by a vehicle while riding his bicycle to work. Although travel to work is usually not covered by workers' compensation, the workers' compensation law judge found that claimant was engaged in a special errand given that he was traveling for the purpose of an overtime assignment and at a location different from his regular work locations. That issue was not addressed by the board. The court wrote, in finding that the claim was compensable, the workers' compensation law judge found that claimant was engaged in a special errand given that he was traveling for the purpose of an overtime assignment and at a location different from his regular work locations. The board, however, did not address the exception relied upon by the workers' compensation law judge, instead found that the outside employee exception did not apply in concluding that the accident did not arise out of or in the course of claimant's employment. Whether an exception to the general rule applies turns on the board's fact-intensive analysis of the particular circumstances of a given case, and the courts are bound by the board's findings of fact, which, including the ultimate fact of arising out of and in the course of employment, must stand unless erroneous in law and regardless of whether conflicting evidence is available. The fact that claimant was not an outside employee, as found by the board, is not dispositive as to whether the special errand exception applies, which was the basis for the law judge's finding that claimant was entitled to workers' compensation benefits. As the board has made no findings of fact with regard to whether the special errand exception applies, the matter must be remitted to the board for further proceedings. So the takeaway here, although injury while traveling to work is usually not covered by workers' compensation, there are exceptions, including the special errand exception, which was deemed to apply here by the workers' compensation law judge. Next is matter of Johnson, pages 38-39, a court of appeals case which deals with how successive injuries to the same part of the body, called a member, should be handled. The court of appeals, over an extensive dissent in each of two cases, held that under workers' compensation law section 15, a subsequent injury to the same body member may be fully compensable, notwithstanding a prior injury involving the same body member. The court wrote, the common issue in these appeals is whether under workers' compensation law section 15, a claimant's schedule loss of use, that's SLU, award must always be reduced by the percentage loss determined for a prior SLU award to a different subpart of the same body member enumerated in section 15. We hold that separate SLU awards for different injuries to the same statutory member are contemplated by section 15, and when a claimant proves the second injury considered by itself and not in conjunction with the previous disability has caused an increased loss of use, the claimant is entitled to a scheduled loss of use award commensurate with that increased loss of use. So the takeaway, a schedule loss of use, that's SLU award, for injury to a body member need not be reduced based upon a prior SLU award for injury to the same body member if the claimant proves the second injury has caused an increased loss of use. Next is matter of Gambardella on pages 39 and 40. Here, the third department, reversing the Workers' Compensation Board, held that the claimant was entitled to a schedule loss of use, that's an SLU award, because he was not eligible for a non-schedule award due to retirement. The court wrote, there's no dispute that claimant was not entitled to a non-schedule award based upon his non-schedule classification because he voluntarily retired in April 2020 and was therefore not attached to the labor market at the time of classification. Thus, as no initial award was made based upon claimant's non-schedule permanent partial disability classification, he is entitled to a schedule loss of use award for the permanent partial impairments to his statutorily enumerated body members. Finally, and contrary to the position taken by the board, the fact that claimant voluntarily retired and was therefore not attached to the labor market does not preclude him from receiving a schedule loss of use award because it is axiomatic that a claimant's lack of attachment to the labor market, voluntary or otherwise, is irrelevant to a determination as to an entitlement to an SLU award. It is worth noting that this workers' compensation case includes a detailed explanation of what a non-schedule award versus a schedule loss of use award is. I didn't summarize that aspect of the decision, but the decision is worth consulting on those issues. Next is the final case in the April 2022 personal injury reversal report. It's matter of Olszewski on pages 40 and 41. Another workers' compensation case deals with the procedures that are unique to workers' compensation. The third department, reversing the workers' compensation board and remitting the matter, held that it was an abuse of discretion to deny claimant's application on the ground that a separate copy of the RB-89 form was not submitted for each claim. The court wrote, we note that the requirement that a party submit a copy of the RB-89 form when referencing multiple claims, or that failing to provide a copy for each claim could result in review being denied on one of the claims, is not included on the form, in the instructions to the form, or in the board's regulations. Although the board may certainly adopt the formatting requirement that applicants provide a copy of their RB-89 form for each claim referenced in it, we find, under the circumstances, that the board's denial of claimant's application for review of the worker compensation law judge's decision for failing to provide the board with an additional copy of their RB-89 form was an abuse of the board's discretion. So we've now completed going through the April 2022 personal injury reversal report, and we will move on to the May 2022 personal injury report.